Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. On the program this evening, it's World Interfaith Harmony Week, promoting goodwill towards all people, regardless of their belief. In a few moments' time, we'll be hearing from the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Dublin and Lendalough, Most Reverend Dr. Michael Jackson, about a new initiative inviting us to become more curious about the faiths of others. But first, the story of an unlikely friendship. Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung and English Dominican priest and theologian Father Victor White spent 15 years in written correspondence exploring the frontier between psychology and religion. Like Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung was a religious man, and however scientific his approach may have been, he was always in search of a deeper insight. The Jung-White letters have inspired a Dublin-based psychotherapist to examine the dialogue between these two men more closely, as well as assessing its value in terms of modern-day mental health. Dr. Mary Stavanazzi has completed a PhD on the subject at the Loyola Institute in Trinity College, Dublin. I met with Mary at her practice recently and began by asking her, are psychotherapy and religion mutually exclusive?
Some would say they are. I don't agree, though. I think they're both covering common ground. I don't think they can afford the luxury of ignoring each other and would expect to be taken to task on that. That was the subject of my research, a theologian who made that argument. He said that it makes life much neater for a psychologist to ignore any of the moral, the deeper spiritual aspects, and very comfortable for a theologian or a priest to ignore the messiness of life. And so he reckoned we can't have that luxury.
And yet they didn't develop in parallel, or did they? Because in many years ago, a person would have gone to a clergyman or a priest for what is now considered to be the equivalent of therapy.
Yeah, and it's often seen that therapy has replaced confession. It would be the nearest parallel. And Victor White's thinking is very interesting on that. I mean, I grew up hearing about confession and never really understood the depth of it till I read his work in comparing and articulating the difference between confession. Whereas he said many of the results or the effectiveness of psychotherapy can look the same as that of confession, but he raises the question, well, where does grace fit? And we can't prove it one way or the other, but we also can't disprove it. So we must be open and keep that possibility there. And it's very interesting as a therapist to be aware, whether you're a believer or not, of the purpose and the function of confession and where it fits, because it can be very useful sometimes to suggest to somebody, if it's relevant and they're a person of faith, that they may like to consider discussing that in confession. And I have seen that been very therapeutic for somebody.
Who defines normal for us now?
That's, I said, normal is a dirty word in my book, because normal changes over time. We see that. Like, look at 50 years ago, people give out about homelessness now, but you wouldn't have seen homelessness 50 years ago because people would be all swept up and they'd be in asylums. So the place would be neat. So, you know, what was normal was, let's say, the people who were left. So normal isn't a good criteria. Normal now, if you're on a bus and everybody is swiping a phone, that's normal. But 10 years ago, people would say, what's wrong with people? Like, there's nobody looking or speaking to anybody. So normal is varying. So that was part of what stimulated my research, because I met the most normal people in psychiatric hospitals. You know, you meet a lot of people so-called successful who are quite scary in the sense of they're driven by money and success. Not that there's anything wrong with them, but as a destiny with no sense of what humanity or at the cost to anybody else. So I suppose that got me digging and searching. And psychology, psychological therapy, anything under the term mental health has no model of health. It's we're working on dysfunction. You learn about you're this, you're that, you're codependent, you're alcoholic, you're the list of things that goes on forever. But I've no picture from my psychological learning of health. So that's what got me digging. And the concept in Christian anthropology of human flourishing and Aristotle's work on, started with Aristotle. And I said, wow, this is the best self-help book I've ever read, because it's given a map, an objective map of the human condition.
So, well, let's explore this a little bit further. That if you think about Even the definition of therapy, here in Ireland, it's still a reasonably unregulated area, and a person can very often describe themselves as a counsellor or a therapist, and so we don't necessarily know what the principle or the thinking is behind them. What is that definition? What are the boundaries of a therapist?
You see, that is the problem. It's not regulated, and it's ongoing. There's discussions ongoing with the Irish Council for Psychotherapy now and the government. But I've been at discussions 15 years ago when it looked like it was going to happen in a month's time. So we'll believe it when we see it. So that's very worrying, because if you take the ethical principle that if somebody's coming for help for anything, there's a presumption of informed consent. So I've been around psychotherapy since 1990. But quite frankly, it's very difficult to make informed consent, because every therapist you meet is going to have a different approach. So it's very important that people ask and that therapists volunteer information before somebody starts. But a lot of people presume, because the difference in what people coming for help, like they may think, I'm like a doctor, I'm going to fix them. Like, that's my initial discussion. People will expect to be fixed and get quite... Some will laugh, some will get annoyed when I say, well, I can't do anything like that. And even if I could, I wouldn't. Because that would be... I can provide you with the skills, we can discuss different angles, we can explore the deeper aspects of what's causing your distress. But if I take your distress away, I would deprive you of a great gift. I see people's distress as it's like the sand in the oyster. We'd have no pearls only for the irritation the oyster suffered. So there's wonderful potential in our irritation, but that's not a very popular statement. But when people run with that and see it and see the logic of it, it makes an awful lot of sense. You know, they see it and they often laugh and say, well, when I came to you first, you didn't give me what I want. I was very disappointed. I thought you were going to cure me, but I'm glad now you didn't give me what I wanted.
I read recently that you quoted Carl Jung on what actually the role of the therapist is.
Yeah, Jung is very interesting on this. It's not about cure or fixing. He says the role of the therapist is to help people with their suffering, how to live with their suffering. So it's how to reach psychological maturity. Like if a child has a pain, it'll scream and it'll kick, I want help and I want it now. But as we grow, as we mature, I was about to say grow older, but it doesn't follow, because we grow older, we mature. You can find very mature people very young and very immature people quite old. So with psychological maturity, we learn to have a capacity. It doesn't mean to enjoy our suffering, but to know it's part of life and to be able to deal with it.
And now I hear you in that statement paralleling what a lot of people of faith would tell you, is that it's not about removing the suffering, but living with it.
Precisely. It's like what would come under, say, the way of the cross is about suffering. And that's where I think Christian anthropology is so important in the psychological health sphere. And whether people believe or not has no bearing on it. As a foundation, as a thinking foundation, it sets the groundwork for how we are as human beings. Like if you go up to IKEA and buy a table, you'll get 20 page instructions how to put it together. But we come into the world and we're kind of playing it by ear, and all our education is on getting jobs, it's on learning the reading, writing, the basics, but there's nothing about psychological maturity. And so, and as a nation, I think we could be described as a nation in a teenage phase of development. If you look at the developmental stages, I often think of, say, you know, stories you've heard from the war, like the maturity that they gained from the suffering they went through. You know, you think of wars, all we've seen in different parts of the world, the capacity of the human spirit to endure.
There's a common theme we've observed on the programme, which is that there's still a great deal of anger from people who may have had faith and have lost it or no longer get the same support or succour from it. Is that what you're referring to in terms of maturity?
Yeah, I would see that as a stage of development. Like, take a teenage, what I mean by teenage stage of development. At the teenage stage, you're rebelling against authority. That's part of your growth and development.
But that authority let a lot of people down.
It did, but it's part of challenging authority. But I think when we grow over that kind of aggressive, we let off a lot of steam, teenage, we go out, stamp out, bang doors. That's because we don't have the language, we don't have the life experience. But as we go on then, we'll be able to challenge that authority. But I think we're stuck in that stage of development. But where I think we're not specific enough is, I would say, from my understanding of the anger people have, as more against clericalism than the teachings of Christianity. Because it was the abuse of authority, the abuse of power, and that wasn't unique to the church. Any profession could be accused of that. Do you know? So I think it's, if you separate the teachings, let's say, the religion is the practice of those teachings, is the way of life associated, and clericalism was, I think, unique to Ireland with our culture and the power. And I think power is an issue in our culture. So I think people are rightfully angry about that. But still, where do they take their authority? Storming doesn't build dialogue. And I think that's where Young, and particularly with White, is extraordinary, because they spent 15 years arguing over a topic, the topic of evil. Like, who would do that today? If I argue with you or most people for half an hour, they're gone, but they're not going to meet you the next time. But to sustain that shows the psychological maturity, the interest in humanity, of the value of the discussion.
You sound like somebody who's gone through that journey yourself. Did you go in and out of your own faith?
I don't know if I was ever in it, to be honest with you. I was what Victor White would call a cradle Catholic. You know, when you're born, something you take it for granted and you doodle on. But I wouldn't have thought it touched me deeply. But it's only when I trace back, I see, and again, because I grew up in an environment that was very, my father was very encouraging to not be disempowered. Like, if as a young person, it probably got me into trouble, because if a teacher or a person in authority spoke to me disrespectfully, I was taught that that's not okay. So they didn't like to see this little toddler kind of saying, well, I don't agree with that. So it, as I got older, it got easier. But so I would have had difficulty with that. But when I trace back, there was that depth of longing for that deeper. And I think it was only when I came across the contemplative tradition in Christianity, I said, God, I am at home here. But I didn't know as a young person that was there. So as a teenager, when I started rebelling, I studied yoga, I studied the Hindu philosophy. I found it so enriching, the talk of a way of life, an ethical code, a practice, how you lived, from how you ate to how your attitude, to how your thinking. And I thought that was different to Christianity. I thought they were completely at odds. And so I presumed Christianity had nothing to offer me. It was only when I came to the contemplative tradition and I came across the work of Thomas Keating, like I said, you know, this is all here. Why has this been kept quiet?
Well, that is the question, because you find yourself going all the way to PhD level on this, which is not what the average man or woman in the street does about their own faith. So a lot of it does remain hidden. Why?
It does, yeah. I think back to the idea of being a cradle Catholic, because we don't have to make any effort. Like, if you think of the interest now in mindfulness and Buddhism, I mean, I've done Buddhist retreats, I've done meditation, I did all the New Age as it was emerging from the 80s, because I was just, as all that was starting in Ireland, I was interested, so I went to everything. But I think of the journeys I took. I went to every godforsaken corner of the country and probably paid through the nose for it, for what I now know is in the Christian tradition that was under my nose. But it's almost like it's not contrary to Christianity, but you don't know it's there. Through my studies, I've met some wonderful theologians, and I've said to all of them, I said, well, why are you speaking to one another in Maynooth about these issues? You should be shouting them from the rooftops, because this is what people are looking for. And whether they believe or not, but you can't believe in something if you don't know what it is. I'm not going to believe in being a Muslim because I don't know enough about it to say I would believe in it or I wouldn't. So there's a certain amount of knowledge, and I don't think we can leave it to what we learned for Holy Communion and Confirmation and say that's it.
Does a therapist have to leave their faith outside the therapy room?
I don't think so. I don't think a therapist can leave any of themselves outside the therapy room. If you do, you're not being genuine. That doesn't mean you're talking about faith. If it arises, but who you are comes into the room. If you try and deny any of who you are, it's like, be careful what you think of, because people know what you're thinking. That happens in therapy. So you must be able to bring all of who you are, and that's not necessarily what you talk about. But I do think that a therapist has a responsibility to know about, I say Christianity because it's the predominant, but it would apply to any religion, but it's the one that's probably most most popular in Ireland, or it's part of our culture, whether we believe it or not. It's a cultural influence as well as a religious influence. Because what I'm concerned about is that how people work as therapists, and when I say therapists, I include doctors, psychiatrists, anybody working with people, is that you can close a door to somebody. So that's what I mean. We don't have to have faith. We don't have to believe in anything if we don't want to. But I think we have a responsibility to keep that door open.
Psychotherapist Dr. Mary Stefanazzi speaking there about the relationship between psychology and religion. Well, this is World Interfaith Harmony Week, promoting goodwill between all people, irrespective of their faith. First proposed and unanimously adopted at the United Nations General Assembly 8 years ago, this event has since been held every year during the first week of February in places of worship throughout the world. Earlier today, in Dublin's City Council Civic Offices on Wood Quay here in Dublin, a new initiative to promote interfaith understanding was launched by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Micheál McDonagh, and Archbishop of Dublin and Lendalough, Most Reverend Dr. Michael Jackson. I spoke with Archbishop Jackson and first of all asked him about the Interfaith Charter. Ireland was the first country where this was signed just over a year ago, and members of the Baha'i, Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jewish and Sikh communities all came together to commit to living in tolerance and peace.
To me, what's important is the sort of words that it brings to the surface, which are what I think you would delight to see alive in a contemporary democracy. And some of those words would seem to me to be words like this: respecting identity, expanding diversity, encouraging harmony, dispelling mythology, and nurturing simplicity. So I think Dublin has done Ireland a great service in this, and also I think then Ireland has done Europe a great service in this, because this idea was taken up very quickly in Europe as something that people wanted to develop as respectful, cultural, faith-based understanding in a range of cities.
Now, we're a naturally curious people, but it's been one area where people have been a little reluctant to actually ask questions of other people.
I think that's true. We're curious, and at the same time, we're quite private about things that matter deeply to us. And in the context of fairly advanced secularisation, not confined to Ireland, but worldwide, I think we're still quite private about faith. The idea of giving a public account of our faith is something very often we'd rather somebody else did for us. But in this context, I think there is an opportunity for people, as it were, to come into the light together and actually to engage and to talk about things that matter to them. One of the exciting things about interfaith engagement is that you need to make a bigger effort to understand your own faith context and your own faith position if you're going to engage with somebody who, as you rightly say, out of curiosity, doesn't actually know what motivates you and doesn't actually know why you do specific things. So I think curiosity, adventure is another word I'd use, and also a degree of privacy come together. But I think in the sort of Ireland in which we live, where we have maybe anything up to 200 different nationalities of people, understanding is very important if we're to build together a credible civil society.
If you look historically in Ireland, and going back many years, but the idea of an interfaith marriage was not something that was built on the basis of having an understanding of another person's faith. In fact, it was seen as a challenge to one's faith.
I would agree with you. I mean, I would have heard conversationally people who would refer to people who are of different Christian denominations saying, but you practice another faith. So in a sense, the depth of our ignorance and our reticence goes back to that. I myself genuinely admire people of, as it were, different world faiths who decide together to create, as it were, a relationship and a family. And how, in a sense, they are both on a journey of discovering the things that are more important together than the things that divide and potentially destroy. And I think there's probably more of this happening than we're aware of, and I think it is something to celebrate.
But if in 2018 somebody actively seeks out a faith or is a convert to a faith, they've often a more insight and dedication to it than somebody who's, you know, born into the faith.
Yeah, I think so, because part of what you're doing is nailing your colours to a particular mast. You will probably, as a child of the modern world, have done a certain amount of research, exploration. And one of the very important things for people of faith to know is that people can be observing, people can be analysing, people can be assessing while those of us who are exponents of faiths actually aren't aware that we're under scrutiny. So it's the informal as well as the formal that can commend or otherwise a faith to people who are exploring.
Now, the initiative that you launched this evening has a practical nature to it, and you built it around five activities or five marks. Could you outline those for us?
I will indeed. What I did was, I suppose, to think laterally from within my own tradition. Within the Anglican tradition, where the Church of Ireland stands, there are five marks of mission. And they actually are nothing to do with being aggressive. They're actually to do with engaging with people wherever your context is. Because across the provinces of the Anglican Communion, we Anglicans are in every place a minority. And so actually for us to engage with people of other world faiths and for people of conscience who have no living or active faith or have set the faith component aside is very important. So what I've tried to do is to take this concept of five marks and see if I can devise five activities which might enable people in my tradition to follow your word of curiosity and my suggestion of adventure around the faith that matters to them and the exploration that others might like to offer as well. Just as an aside, may I suggest, towards the end of last year, I was invited to a gathering of Muslims and asked to talk about five aspects of the Reformation, which I found quite interesting to try and draw them out, not least in relation to some sort of conversation around the five pillars of Islam, but that's really only an aside. The sort of things I was thinking about, simple. First of all, take what I would suggest is the bedrock of the Christian faith, the scriptures, and those invitations that there are in both Old and New Testament to love God and to love your neighbour as yourself. Explore scenarios, explore meetings between and across people where we see that happening and actually begin to lift those and celebrate them. Another thing I would suggest is carefulness around language, and in relation to regular Sunday or weekday intercessions, try and draw out positive exploration of relationships with people of other world faiths, and in a regular human way, pray for them, facing the same sort of challenges, celebrating the same sort of occasions as all human beings do, and they're, as it were, their watering hole is going to be their place of faith. So those would be two of them. Another thing I would suggest is that it's very important for people of faith to claim public space. Not in an aggressive way at all, but actually if the space is public, it's important, I think, for people of faith to belong there and to feel that that's a comfortable place to be. So I'd like to think that people in a local geography would actually take that space and do something for everybody, for the community there.
And that was one of my questions to you, which was that if this is an initiative that you want people to take, where do you want them to take it?
Well, I'll give you an example. Every year there is an interfaith picnic in Merrion Square. Lots of people come to that. I mean, interfaith works well with food, I tell you. People enjoy exploring other people's food. It's very important that whatever you prepare is culturally and ritually possible for others to eat. But people do enjoy that. So that's one place. The other thing I would suggest would be in community centres, because I think there is, as you say, tremendous curiosity. So there's be three things. I think a social event which happens in the religious space which matters to you and to matters to your new faith friend is important. Because if you go into a building that's set aside for sacred use, you're right to ask questions and other people are right to ask questions of you. Why is that there? Who sits there? If it's a church, why is there nobody sitting in the front? You know, all of these questions, they're all worth asking. What actually happens in the sanctuary? What can lay people do? What can religious leaders do? These sort of things that open up understanding. And so, and I suppose the final thing I would suggest is probably to visit the place of worship of an interfaith friend and to be present there for an act of worship itself. I'll just give you a small example. I happened to be in Tirana in Albania and I was there for a conference on persecution. I arrived early and there was a small mosque, which had survived. It actually survived, interestingly, because it was deemed to be a cultural place. And I went and I said, may I sit and pray? I took off my shoes, I sat, and there was absolutely no problem. That was after I had been to worship in the Greek Orthodox Cathedral. So I think you can bring your own faith and belief and connection with God into another space without insult and without losing any of your principles.
Now, I presume you would also be encouraging dialogue. So people would sit and they would ask these questions, maybe bust a few myths would be the parlance that people would use now as they do it. Is there room for people of no faith in that process?
I think there is. And I think it's important that we should have a mature attitude within ourselves to people of no faith. Because people of no faith also, I think, are helping with everybody to build a functioning and a fair and a compassionate community in human society. So I think that is a very important component as well. We all, I think, need the goodwill and the positive intention of each other, and I'd like it to include that as well.
Finally, Archbishop, when people have completed this process, what is the outcome then?
Well, from the perspective of the Dublin Interfaith Forum, what we've agreed thus far is that a copy of the Interfaith Charter would be given to the community, and they could put this up either in the church or in the hall or wherever they meet. Another hope and aspiration we have is that, a little bit like the green flags in schools, we might have an interfaith flag which could actually be flown in this place, because I think that's also important. Flags are things of celebration and other things of complexity, but I think if we can reclaim this, that I think would be very important. The Dublin Interfaith Forum and its website, that's the place to go for more information. We're beginning a journey. I would say that I'm starting this within my own tradition. Other faith traditions will have to work out what works for them, and they, in a sense, will have to devise their own five steps or five marks or five expressions. But to me, the exciting thing is that as we draw this together, we'll get a much stronger sense of what it is to engage around dialogue, respect, and developing a faith understanding which leads towards a much more public understanding of people to whom we're different and who are different from us.
Most Reverend Dr. Michael Jackson, the Archbishop of Dublin and Glendalough, who, with Lord Mayor of Dublin Micheál McDonaghy, earlier today launched a new initiative to promote interfaith understanding. And that's the Leap of Faith for this week. Tomorrow is the Feast of St. Blaise, physician, martyr and bishop, whose blessing of the throat is often availed of by singers, preachers and occasional broadcasters to ward off the ills of the vocal cords. From all of us here tonight, good night.